This is Lawrence Spivak inviting you to Meet the Press.
Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air and winner of every major award in its field, is a public affairs presentation of NBC News.
Our guest today on Meet the Press is the chairman of the subcommittee which recently completed extensive hearings on the problems of American cities, Senator Abraham Ribicoff, Democrat of Connecticut. Senator Ribicoff has had one of the most varied experiences in government. Before coming to the Senate in 1963, he served as a state legislator, a judge, a member of the House of Representatives, a governor, and as Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. We'll have the first questions now from Sander Van Oker of NBC News.
Senator Ribicoff, did you hold these hearings because you wanted to dramatically demonstrate your dissatisfaction with the administration over its approach to the cities?
No, I held these hearings to understand what the problems of the cities really were.
But, Senator, are you satisfied with what the administration has done?
No, I am not.
Why not, sir?
Because the problems are so deep and vast that we have reached the stage in America where we have to take a new approach to the problems of the city. The Great Society is the end of an era. We are now ready to enter a new era.
In this new era, Senator, does the federal government have the role that it formerly had in this area?
Its role should be a changing role with more emphasis on the private sector of our economy.
Is there something peculiar to this administration, or do you feel it's just peculiar to the kind of administrations we have in this half of the 20th century?
No, because it's peculiar to the great changes that have taken place in America and that exist today.
The Senator, as someone who came up in the New Deal era of the Democratic Party, are you saying now the New Deal is dead? And that if this is so, then the Democratic Party is going to have to change its approach?
Not at all. The New Deal has succeeded. What Lyndon Johnson achieved was to write a brilliant concluding factor to the continuation of a process started with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, going some 30 years through five presidents. And the achievements of the Great Society and the legislative successes of Lyndon Johnson from 1963 through 1966 was the end of a brilliant chapter. We are now ready to enter a new one, and I believe that President Johnson will have the foresight to take the American people there.
Yes, but you seem to indicate in your hearings that you were ready to write the new chapter, that the Congress was going to write the new chapter.
Let me say this. I am going to try, but I am under no illusions. It'd be pretty tough for a senator to write the new chapter. The leadership must come from the President of the United States.
Well, Senator, will your sense of modesty be so overwhelming that you won't submit proposals in the forthcoming session?
As a matter of fact, I will have a series of proposals to submit right after the President's State of the Union message.
Thank you, Senator Ribicoff. The other reporters on our panel today are Haynes Johnson of the Washington Evening Star, Robert Semple Jr. of the New York Times, and Richard Wilson of the Coles Publications. We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Johnson.
Well, Senator Ribicoff, you say that you are not satisfied with what the Johnson administration has done about the problems of the cities, and you also say that you have new proposals to submit when Congress resumes. Could you be more specific? What has the Johnson administration not done that you would like to see it do, number one, and what are some of these concrete proposals you're going to make?
Well, basically, I think the emphasis has to change on jobs. The key to the problems of the city is self-respect for the inhabitants of the city, and jobs are what will do that for them. It seems to me that the government should be the employer of last resort, and there should be established a Public Service Employment Opportunities Act in the Department of Commerce, in which training and a census will be taken of job opportunities that if private industry cannot take care of the jobs through training and through government service, these jobs will be supplied on a federal, state, or local or community level. That's one phase. The second phase is that of the question of housing. Now, it's apparent to me that the time has come to go beyond a demonstration city or a model city program. The problems are too vast and too deep. There are some 4 million housing units needed in the United States of America. I would propose that there be set up a program of $50 billion, $5 billion a year, to take care of rebuilding the slums of America. I don't necessarily conceive this to be completely on a federal level. I look to this to be a cooperative effort from private industry, a cooperative effort from localities, from foundation, and also the private sector. In order to do this, I would have set up first in the Department of HUD a research and development agency modeled after NASA, in which there would be the research and development to make sure that we use the modern techniques, the modern methods, modern materials, and modern procedures to bring the cost of housing down to about half of what it is today. This would be done on a contract basis. I would have this group, which would have a group of advisors taken from the business community and labor and the professions and the community, to give the direction and the seed money out into the communities. I would then set up in the communities a neighborhood development agency, with each neighborhood making its own decision and its own direction. Here would be a job for OEO to give the direction to the neighborhood groups. And that I would look forward to the development of America, which has facing it a $1 trillion, $1,000 billion job to rebuild the cities of America. You should also keep in mind that we are growing so rapidly that it becomes very important that we supply an additional housing for 2 million people a year as we are growing that rapidly.
Well, Senator, where are you talking about in terms of a $1 trillion job and $50 billion program? Where is this money going to come from when we're fighting increasing or escalating war in Vietnam and the president's having trouble even getting through a small appropriation for the war on poverty?
That money can come from the natural growth. I don't look at this money being spent next year. We start with a demonstration city program of some $920 million. I look for this program starting 3 years from now, but the plans should be made. We now have a gross national product of some $750 billion. We are growing rapidly, and the normal growth will give us this additional increment. But the needs are there in such great amount that private enterprise, from the pure profit motive, will be able to step in and do the job from private resources, and I don't look at this job being done from government resources.
Mr. Semple.
Following up on Mr. Johnson's question, Senator, how do you see private enterprise being attracted into the slum areas? For years, banks have been unwilling to make loans for rehabilitation purposes in slum areas, because they're not at all certain they're going to get their money back. The markets are extremely risky. And for the same reason, construction companies have been inhibited from going into the slums. How specifically would your program lure the enormous technological resources of private industry into the slums?
I would say there would have to be government guarantees. There would have to be a cheap credit. If you give cheap credit to nonprofit organizations, the same cheap credit can be given to private industry, who I think can build cheaper and better than a nonprofit organization. And then you would give certain tax breaks to companies who would go into these areas. And in this way, you would be able to involve the private sector. I also see, in building up these areas, that you will not only be building housing, you will be building factories, you will be building stores, you will be building office buildings, and these will be profit-making. And the private sector will be keeping this share for their profit. I would also foresee a matter of rent subsidies to take care of the proper rent payments that would have to be made for a break-even point. But if you gave private industry the same guarantees that you gave public housing or the nonprofit institution, you could involve private industry in the rebuilding the cities of America.
Mr. Wilson.
Senator, in hearing you outline the rather ambitious program which you have in mind, the thought has occurred to me that your aspirations in this respect may be incompatible with the election returns of last November. which seemed to show a reaction against such things as the poverty program and other aspects of the Great Society. Do you think there is an incongruity there between what you want to do and what the people want to do?
I don't think the election returns show that incongruity at all. I think the election returns show a reaction to a great victory in 1964, half of it attributable to Lyndon Johnson and the other half attributable to the weakness of Barry Goldwater. The reaction, the swing, was normal to come back in 1966, but it was little stronger than otherwise. I would say that the reaction was not to the programs of the Great Society, but the reaction to our involvement in Vietnam, high interest rates, tight credit, were many of the factors that were involved. Furthermore, the Republicans put up some very attractive candidates who had a great appeal. All of these were factors. Keep in mind that the Great Society programs were programs that were voted for overwhelmingly in Congress by both Democrats and Republicans. And I don't know anyone who advocates the repeal of education, Medicare, air or water pollution, or other programs.
It was the very point about the administration of the Great Society programs, the poverty program, and others, which brought the Democratic governors together recently in White Sulphur Springs. And during the course of that meeting, they blamed the Johnson administration and the Great Society for being responsible for the diminished Democratic majorities in the last election.
Respectfully, as a former governor, I don't think these governors knew what they were talking about. They were trying to place upon the shoulders of the president some blame that they probably should take on themselves. Basically, they were in their own states. They had a job to do. And I am sure that each and every one of these governors aren't refusing the programs of the federal government, but probably want more of them. I think that they were taking advantage of the fact of the drop of Lyndon Johnson's popularity by trying to make him a scapegoat. And I think the governors were wrong in criticizing the president.
And you would not agree that you will go into the next Congress with a more hostile attitude towards some of these social welfare programs?
I think we will go into Congress with a more hostile attitude towards these programs, but I do believe that you can straighten out many of these programs and get more for the money you are spending and get congressional support if the president is willing to take the lead and go to the country and fight for them.
Senator, may I ask you a question? There are a good number of Democrats who worried about 68, worried about running with Lyndon Johnson at the head of the ticket. Now, you're running in 68. Are you worried about that?
No, I'm not. I think Lyndon Johnson will be nominated by acclamation and will have a very resounding victory. Basically, a man who runs for public office runs on his party record, but runs on his own record as well. I am not worried about that at all. And neither should the Democratic Party. I don't think the Democratic Party should apologize for Lyndon Johnson. It should be proud of Lyndon Johnson.
Are you at this time prepared to come out for him in 1968?
Well, I'm out for him right today. There's no question about that.
Mr. Vinoker.
Senator, if you're not concerned, why are you taking an increasingly independent position from the president on a number of issues such as Vietnam and the cities?
Well, let me put it this way. I respect Lyndon Johnson, but I also respect my own point of view. I wasn't sent to the United States Senate just to be a sounding board for any president of the United States. The people of Connecticut didn't send me to Washington to be a vegetable. They sent me to Washington to do my own thinking. I happen to have thoughts of my own. I've talked enough to the president that I think the president respects a man who has ideas of his own, who is willing to come up with alternatives. My understanding from my conversations with the president, he's impatient with people who criticize but who have no alternatives. I criticize, but I've never criticized a president without coming up with an alternative of my own.
But, Senator, isn't there, and I'm not trying to create a feud between you and the president, but isn't there a fundamental difference in the approach he has toward what the federal government can do and the approach that you and other senators have? I detected in the hearings a bias on your part against the government doing any of these things. Indeed, when you asked Walter Reuther on this very point about the 4 million housing units, whether the government should do it, even Walter Reuther said no, and you smiled with pleasure at his response.
I am not sure what the president thinks at the present time. I am not sure that the proposals that we will make will find disfavor in the eyes of the president. My understanding is that the executive branch is given considerable concern and studied to these hearings. I've been told that by some of my friends in the executive branch. And my hope is that the president has the wisdom to see a good idea when it is advanced. I hope that some of my ideas are good enough and that he will accept some of them.
Mr. Johnson.
Senator, you've said that you've been critical many times of the bureaucracy, the federal bureaucracy. I think you've said that the bureaucracy is afraid of ideas, frozen attitudes. How is this going to change? And it will have to change if your program is going to be successful.
Public opinion will change it. I think what these hearings achieved was an educational process. They were very widely covered by the press and television and radio. There was deep concern expressed by the American people, and I think there is an understanding of the depth of these problems and the importance to the future of America and the dynamics of the situation will carry them along.
Let me ask you something else about the specific problems of the cities. First of all, are you in favor of a guaranteed income for people?
No, I am not. I am for a guaranteed job, but not for a guaranteed annual income, because I think a guaranteed annual income takes away incentives and lose self-respect. One of the things that shone through these hearings was the desire of the Negroes and the poor whites in the slums for self-respect and a job. They didn't want a handout. I would start going away from the so-called welfare program to job training, and my emphasis will be away from welfare. Now, when you talk about guaranteed income, I am against a guaranteed income for an able-bodied person who can work or who can be trained to work.
Mr. Semple.
Senator Ribicoff, in the old days before the Ribicoff hearings on the cities, when people talked about the downtown ghetto, which is largely Negro, they usually talked in terms of breaking it up, either by moving whites in through the urban renewal process or moving the Negroes out, dispersing them into better housing in the suburbs through rent supplement programs or through some fair housing legislation. But I detected in the course of these hearings very little emphasis on that kind of philosophy. By and large, most of the witnesses, including the liberals and including the Negroes, seem to regard integration as a remote and rather visionary dream and would infinitely prefer putting all our resources into making the ghetto better. I don't know if I make my distinction clear, but would you agree with that latter approach?
There is no question about it. I do agree with you, Bob. The question of integration and, again, segregated housing is an ideal that we should try to work forward to make it a reality. However, the realization has come out that what is important is quality in housing and quality in education and quality in environment, and breaking the slums as an airtight cage. That is the prime objective, and I think we have to go toward building better housing, better education, a better city, a more competent city. And I think this is the key to the future.
In effect, therefore, what we're really trying to do now is upgrade the ghetto rather than...
Upgrade the ghetto, and the interesting thing is, what comes out of these hearings, is that while you have a 35 million very unhappy Americans, they are not revolutionary. They want a piece of the middle class. They want in. And we have achieved beyond our wildest dreams as a productive society as having a group of people who are outside the mainstream of American society, not wanting to overthrow it, but just wanting a piece of it and to have what they see the middle class has. And I think that we should try in their hopes and aspirations to achieve it, which I think we can do within the programs that now exist.
Mr. Wilson.
Senator, one note which I think came out of your hearings came from some of the leaders who said that unless the poverty program was continued, unless some of the other programs were continued, that there would be widespread disorder in the Negro sections and other sections of large cities. Were they, in effect, threatening Congress with disorders if billions of dollars were not appropriated for use in the cities?
I don't look at it that way, Dick. I mean, violence has always been part of the slums of the world, whether Balzac was writing about Paris, or Dickens was writing about London, or Jacob Riis was writing about New York 50 years ago. The hopelessness and frustration brings violence to the slums of the world, no matter where they may be. I think what was being brought out was that we had raised the hopes and expectations of the people in the ghettos through the poverty programs and other programs of the Great Society. Suddenly, these hopes are withdrawn, and with it come frustration. And with it, frustration, when you have nothing to gain, is what difference does it make if you have violence? As Floyd McKissick pointed out, that basically, what are we talking about of not saving or violating a piece of property if a person doesn't own a piece of property? I think what we ought to do is try to give them a piece of ownership in America.
I noted that Bayard Rustin said that people should be taught to play musical instruments and to play games and other things, which he says they spend most of their time doing anyway. And the government ought to put up the money for that sort of activity. Would you favor that kind of thing, to keep quiet and tranquility?
It isn't quiet and tranquility. I think what you were talking about is lifting a person's dignity and self-respect. And what we have to keep in mind, too, is that we're talking mostly of saving children. Out of the 35 million people in poverty, 14.5 million of those are children. Out of the 7.5 million people on welfare, 3.5 million are children. And if America is going to break down the vicious cycle of one generation after another generation on relief and welfare, we have to address ourselves to the program of salving the children in health, in education, and job training to give them some meaning for America.
I wonder if you and I are not talking about two different things. What I'm talking about is the more recent idea that there should be and must be organized violence and disorder in crowded areas of cities in order to obtain the objectives that are sought by Negroes and whites, for that matter.
There mustn't
now, that's
be.
Somewhat different than your general approach of lifting up the standards of life of people who live in that area over a long-range program. But haven't they introduced an element here which has caused a widespread reaction against the very things that you want to do?
It has caused reaction, but that doesn't take away from the fact that frustration brings violence and hopelessness brings violence. And I think that we can't take away the hope that we have given the people in the slums through the programs we have passed during the last 3 years.
Gentlemen, we have less than 2 minutes. Senator, I'd like to ask you a question. You were reported as saying that a good way for the president to save money is to eliminate programs that don't work. What programs do you think among the poverty programs aren't working?
It isn't a question of eliminating programs that don't work, but it's making more use of the programs that we have. We spend $2.5 billion for hospitals in America since 1947. There's no hospital in Watts. We have an Economic Development Administration which builds up industries in the rural area but isn't allowed to build up industry in the cities. We have spent $250 million for Head Start, another $250 million for elementary and secondary education in the summer programs, but these don't have the results. I am pointing out that we take the same tools that we have and make them more effective. We take the question of housing. I think we ought to phase out of public housing and go into ownership housing, condominiums, co-ops. These laws are on the books. I am asking the President of the United States and the executive branch to take the programs now on the books and give them more meaning so we will get the most use out of the dollars we are spending.
Mr. Van Elker.
Senator Ribicoff, isn't there a vested interest in the welfare of this country, a bureaucracy that's grown up around it, private and federal and state, that's going to prevent you or the president from doing this?
It doesn't have to if there are enough people who are willing to talk intelligently and fight against it. I think it can be done.
But there is one, is there not?
There is. There is a bureaucracy, and it's a continuous one and a tough one. And they have a vested interest in things as they are. The time has come to change it, and I think it can be changed.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is up. Thank you, Senator Ribicoff, for being with us today on Meet the Press. I'll tell you about next week's guests after this message.
For a printed copy of today's interview, send 10 cents in coin and a stamp, self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, Box 2111, Washington, D.C., 20013.
Next week on Meet the Press, our guests will be the two Republican leaders of the House of Representatives, Gerald R. Ford of Michigan, Minority Leader, and Melvin R. Ladd, Chairman of the Republican Conference. Now, this is Lawrence Spivak saying goodbye for Senator Abraham Ribicoff and Meet the Press.
Hi, this is Joe Garagiola. To me, there are two basic parts of sports, the games and the people who play them. On the Joe Garagiola Sports Show, I'm usually talking about the people, but that doesn't mean that I'm not aware of the importance of the games themselves. NBC Radio is aware of that importance, too, and that's why they'll be bringing you one of the biggest one-day football schedules in history tomorrow. It's a bowl game triple-header, and you can hear every exciting play of the three top bowl games right here on this NBC Radio station. The first one on the schedule is the Sugar Bowl game from New Orleans, which brings together Nebraska and Alabama. From there, NBC Radio will take you to Pasadena, California, for the granddaddy of all bowl games, the Rose Bowl. This year, that means Southern California against Purdue. And in the evening, in Miami's Orange Bowl, Florida meets Georgia Tech in the windup of the big triple header. So if you're a football fan, the ticket to three top attractions is yours for the dialing, right here on NBC Radio.
This is Morgan Beatty, NBC News, asking, what about today's rebellious young? Are they cool cats, swingers? What do they believe? Or do today's youngsters from 14 through 17 grow up without beliefs?
We're doing what we feel like doing, just ourselves. We're real. As far as I'm concerned, I'm real. I'm as real as can be.
Some youngsters are caught up in the cool rebellion.
Well, it's pretty common. Just about every school kid that I know that's going to these suburb schools are supposed to be clean cut and take dope.
Second Sunday, the NBC Radio documentary series on provocative subjects. Next Sunday, the series takes a fascinating look at young teenagers, kids caught up in the cool rebellion. Listen as my colleague Bill Ryan questions guys who look like dolls and dolls who wear miniskirts over most of these NBC stations next Sunday.
Join us each Sunday for News in the Making, as the nation's top reporters put challenging questions to world leaders on Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air.
This is Mel Allen. Georgia Tech meets Florida in the Orange Bowl football game tomorrow. Follow the action on NBC Radio and Television.